You're listening to Wheelationships.
The common question that we're trying to answer is, why do smart people make dumb choices? That's the common question. Why do smart people make dumb choices? A better question is probably, how do they go about it? Not why, but how do smart people make dumb choices? What are the things that lead to us making dumb choices? Both smart people and the rest of us. And an even better question is, how do I make a better choice? Instead of the dumb choice that I would naturally make, how do I make a better choice? So that's kind of the goal and the aim of what we're trying to do. I mention this verse every week, Proverbs 30, verse 2, I am too stupid to be human and I lack common sense. It's kind of our guiding verse. We've been talking about these 10 emotions that lead to dumb choices. And the first one we talked about was anger. We talked about how to make a better choice when you get angry, because we're all going to get angry, and being angry isn't necessarily bad. But because we tend to follow what we feel, then that anger can lead us to some pretty stupid choices. We talked about greed and how that developing an attitude and a life of generosity will help us to make better choices. When those greedy and selfish and grabby kind of feelings come and we want to protect what we have, then kind of developing that generosity within us will lead us in a better direction than following the greed. Like I said, I have no idea what you covered with Wendell last week. So probably some of the discussion touched on this particular emotion. Today we're going to talk about this emotion that we could spend weeks on, and maybe we will someday. So let this discussion of what we discussed today about this particular emotion of fear, let it serve as kind of a let it serve to provoke you to acts of love and kindness and good deeds. Kind of dwell on this and use it, and you're going to have to just probably think about some of this for a while. We're going to say a little bit, and hopefully the Holy Spirit will multiply it in your heart and your mind and over the next week or so. The emotion we want to talk about is fear. And, of course, you can't talk about fear without talking about phobias. And you can't talk about phobias, well, you could, but what fun is that? So you have the ones that you've never heard of. I wanted to see if you've heard of these, okay? Because I looked them up. These are all in the dictionary. So if you can tell me what these phobias are, my college graduate here, she's ready. She's ready to go. Cathesophobia.
Ready, cameras.
No. That's not it, but I have that fear. Yeah. Fear of sitting. Obviously, you've all conquered that fear. Fear of sitting. Fear of sitting. S-I-T-T-I-N-G. You've all gotten over that one. That's good. Pelodophobia. No? And Kelly and Mary Jane both got over this one. It's fear of bald people. Arachnophobia, for whatever phobia.
Something with spiders?
You would think spiders. No.
A butane lighter. What?
Fear of peanut butter sticking to the roof of your mouth. Why do you know that?
Very good.
I'm not making any of these up. Fear of peanut butter sticking to the roof of your mouth.
Wow.
Olophobia. Olophobia. Not auto, but it's an L. A-U-L-O phobia.
Fear of everything.
It's fear of flutes. Flutes. Nomatophobia.
Fear of naming things.
Fear of names. Fear of names.
I mean, you have a name.
Ah, see, so you
don't
got
it,
you got over it.
Yeah.
It's fear of, I don't know. And the last, so if you have a flute playing bald person with eating peanut butter sitting down, that would be a problem. I don't know. This is my favorite, electorophobia. Fear of chickens.
Oh, I would have said.
Fear of, she's got a fear of roosters. I don't know what that is, but fear of chickens. We'll share it later. Okay, I don't need to. The thing is, I don't need to convince any of you that fear can be a very bad emotion with on which to base your actions, right? I mean, because you'll end up running from chickens. I don't know.
Bald people.
Or bald people. Or squirrels. Yeah. One of the...
I'm glad he doesn't have a cat there.
One of the...
I'm sorry,
too. One of the things I've tried to tell our kids since they were old enough to understand what I was saying, and sometimes I'm wondering if they still are, but one of the things I've tried to tell them is you cannot let fear keep you from doing what you need to do. That you know that there are a lot of times in life where you may not have a phobia about it, but you just may be anxious, you may be nervous, you may feel that shrinking back, and I really don't want to do this. It's a fear, but you got to do it anyway. You just, some things you just got to do. You have to talk to people. You have to, you know, get out of your comfort zone. You have to do some things that you're not necessarily comfortable with doing. And I try to tell them, you know, again and again, you can't let fear keep you from doing what you need to do. So I don't think I need to convince you that. There are plenty of things that are going to try to make us afraid and keep us out of the direction and the intent of what God wants to do in our lives, whether it's the big things or the small things. And we can't listen to the fear. Now, you have this parable, Matthew 25, which you know, parable of the servants. You know the parable where each of the servants was given a different amount, and then you have in verse 14, again, the kingdom of heaven can be illustrated by the story of a man going on a long trip. He called together his servants and entrusted his money to them while he was gone. Now notice, entrusted, he placed in trust so that the servants would treat it not as their own, but just like the master would. That's important. Okay. Then notice this, when the third servant reveals his failure and the master's response to that in verse 25, I was afraid I would lose your money. I was afraid I would lose your money. So I hid it in the earth. Look, here is your money back. But the master replied, you wicked and lazy servant. Clearly, fear helped the servant make a dumb decision. And he got thrown into outer darkness and all that. But what is the fear that, and what is it about fear that tricks our brains, our smart brains, into making dumb decisions? When, you know, what can we do about that? How can we make it from a dumb decision into something else and avoid that trap? So here's the truth you can count on. And you have handouts there somewhere. Anytime fear fuels our decisions, we arrive at the place we were trying to avoid. Anytime fear fuels our decision, we end up at the place we arrive at the place we were trying to avoid. Let me tell you a story. Jacob Van Zanten was one of the most experienced and accomplished pilots in the world. Captain Van Zanten's attention to detail, methodical approach, and spotless record made him a natural choice to head his airline safety program. The airline made Captain Van Zanten their star, put him in magazine ads. One magazine ad featuring the smiling captain said it all, from the people who made punctuality possible. Today's trip was moving along with smooth precision that had become his hallmark. The schedule was straightforward. Land in Las Palmas, refuel, and transport a new set of passengers back home to Holland. But then Van Zanten got a message from air traffic control. A terrorist bomb had exploded at the airport flower shop, causing massive chaos on the ground, and Las Palmas would be closed until further notice. The captain knew that at times like this, the most important thing was to remain calm and proceed with caution. He had performed drills preparing for this kind of situation countless times. In fact, Van Zanten had just returned from leading a six-month safety course on how to react in this kind of situation. Following standard procedure, the captain obeyed orders to land 50 nautical miles from his original destination on the island of Tenerife. There at 1:10 p.m., his plane joined several others that had been similarly diverted. Tenerife was a tiny airport with a single runway not meant to support jumbo jets. With his plane safely tucked at the edge of the runway, the captain checked his watch. Seeing the time, he was struck with a worrisome thought, the mandated rest period. The government had recently instituted strict, complicated rules to which every pilot had to adhere. After getting in touch with HQ and performing some quick calculations, Van Zanten figured the latest he could take off was 6:30 p.m. Flying after the start of the mandated rest period was out of the question. It wasn't just against policy, it was a crime punishable by imprisonment. But taking the rest period would open up its own can of worms. Here in Tenerife, there would be no replacement crew to take over. Hundreds of passengers would be stranded overnight. That would mean the airline would have to find some place for them to stay, and there wasn't enough hotel rooms on this little island. In addition, a delay here would initiate a cascade of flight cancellations throughout the airline system. A seemingly minor diversion could easily become a logistical nightmare. It was like being stuck at a red light when you're late for a big meeting. You know that, gotta go. Try as you might to stay calm, you know that your reputation is on the line. Your frustration grows, and there's not really much you could do. But there was one thing that Van Zanten could do. The captain decided to keep the passengers on board so that when Las Palmas reopened, he could get back in the air immediately. 20 minutes turned into an hour. The captain spent every moment thinking of ways to minimize the delay. He held a strategy session with his crew. He called headquarters to find out exactly how much time he had left before the mandated rest period kicked in. An hour on the ground turned into two. Then the captain came up with another idea. He decided to refuel at Tenerife and thus shave a half hour off the turnaround at Las Palmas. But as soon as Van Zanten started refueling, word came from Las Palmas that the airport had finally opened. But it was too late to stop the 35-minute refueling process. Not only did this stop Van Zanten, but his plane and the refueling truck were partially obstructing access to the runway. And so other planes, including a waiting Pan Am jet that could have left, was lacking just 12 feet of clearance and had to wait. Finally, just when it looked like Van Zanten's plane was set to go, a thick layer of fog descended upon the runway. Can you feel his... So, with the fog growing thicker, visibility dropped to just 300 meters, so poor that gazing out the cockpit window, the captain couldn't see the end of the runway. Van Zanten knew that every moment the fog got worse made it that much likelier that Tenerife Tower would shut down the airport. He saw that his window of opportunity to get out of Tenerife before an overnight stay was closing. It was now or never, time to go. But what the captain did next was completely out of character. Van Zanten revved up the engines, and the plane lurched down the runway. "Wait a minute," Van Zanten's co-pilot said in confusion. "We don't have ATC clearance." "I know that," replied the captain as he hit the brakes. "Go ahead and ask." The co-pilot got on the radio and received airway clearance, approval of the flight plan. But the tower said nothing about the vital takeoff clearance. And in fact, there was radio failure at that point. There was some miscommunication. and yet determined to take off, Van Zanten turned the throttles to full power and roared down the foggy runway. KLM 4805. Yeah, if you remember, that was back in the 70s. Collided with the Pan Am jet that was taxiing, and 584 people lost their lives, including everybody on Van Zanten's plane. What happened? Now, there were a lot of things that went wrong. The delay, the small airport, the fog, the little mistakes, radio interference. But in the end, it was determined by the investigators that Captain Van Zanten, the calm, collected, cool head of the safety program, Captain Van Zanten, had made a very dumb decision. Why? Well, we're going to look at a couple of reasons why, and I think it applies to us. We're going to look at these fear factors. Fear factors. What's more, well, let me just give you the first one. First kind of factor in something that'll make your fear drive you to a dumb decision is we have an irrational aversion to loss. We have an irrational, dumb aversion to loss. I mean, what's more important, being on time or arriving? Obviously, arriving would be more important, to just get there. And you would think that the captain would have been more averse to the potential loss of life of 584 people, even his own life. But the thought of another plane being on the runway at that point didn't cross his mind. That wasn't what he was focused on. What he was focused on was what he was about to lose. He was about to lose the opportunity to go. He was about to lose, you know, all this structure and all the things, being on time, his punctuality. I mean, he's had his face in the magazine about being on time. He was about to cause everybody within the entire KLM system to be late because he was being late. That's the loss he was focused on. And so it made him make a really, really dumb decision. What he responded to was the loss of what he was afraid of. See, we can get so anxious about what we might lose, we make some very dumb choices. Choices that can damage our relationships, choices that can ruin what God wants to do in our life, because we get focused on what am I going to lose. It's like swerving to avoid the squirrel in the middle of the road, right into oncoming traffic. It's kind of a dumb decision, but we get focused on the loss. I mean, we have several people that work on the interstate, and they can tell you how the number of people that have rollover accidents on the interstate because they make a small little mistake and then they overcorrect, and there they go. Am I right, Royce?
Yeah.
Accidents that are just a slight mistake, but then we overreact, because that's the second thing. We overreact to perceived losses. We overreact to perceived losses. We think we're losing time. You ever overreact to losing time? Going to be late? You know, and you make a dumb choice. You make a dumb relationship choice because of a very small, you know, perceived loss. We think we're losing opportunity. We perceive that we're going to lose pleasure. You know, I want to do this, and the opportunity to have that pleasure is being taken away from me, and we overreact. Ideally, we put it into perspective. We see what we're going to lose, and we put it in perspective and put it into the right slot. And it may be a very big thing, and we respond in an appropriate way. Or it may be a very small thing, and we respond in an appropriate way, but naturally we don't. Just naturally, the way we are, we don't. We overreact. Anybody? Yes, sir. Oh, yeah.
You react at the bottom of the investment
fear of bailout.
Mm-hmm.
90% of people fail in the stock market is we react a lot with fear on the
policy. Absolutely. Yeah. You go back to what Trudy said a couple weeks about greed, and you can pull some of this in. Let me give you another economic example. Economic theory suggests that if you lower the price just a little bit, then people are going to buy a little bit more. If you raise the price a little bit, people will buy a little bit less. So they did a study of egg buyers in California. And they reduced the price of eggs just a little. And sure enough, consumers bought a little bit more because it was a little bit cheaper. Then they increased the price by the same amount, and consumers cut their consumption by 2.5 times. Because there was a perceived loss, and we tend to overreact to that. I can't buy eggs. You know, gas goes up 3 pennies and we go, oh, my goodness. Think about it. Okay, they studied, by the way, did you see the news this morning? It's supposed to go down 50 cents before summer. Anyway, yay.
Somebody must be doing a study.
Yeah. Same thing happened with orange juice buyers in Indiana. They cut the price a little and people bought a little bit more. They raised the price a little and boom, they stopped buying. Here's what they concluded. We experience the pain associated with the loss much more vividly than we do the joy of experiencing a gain. We experience the pain associated with the loss much more vividly than we do the joy associated with a gain. How much more vividly do you experience a criticism than you do a compliment? How many of you, either with your cell phone or your home phone, you have a plan that gives you so many minutes a month? Most everybody? Okay. How many of you with one of those plans that, you know, has a flat rate and you get so many minutes a month, how many of you run over your minutes? Anybody run over?
Did one.
Only one.
And then what happened?
No, I straightened it out. I made it higher.
You bumped up your plan. Have you run over since?
No.
Have you got close?
Yes.
Okay. Very, very often?
No.
See, that's why I buy the unlimited.
You don't have to worry. You just go for the unlimited.
Right.
Exactly.
I went for the unlimited plan.
Okay. That's an example of how we avoid loss. In many cases, a pay-as-you-go plan is cheaper. But for anybody that's been on a pay-as-you-go plan and you've had a bad month, boom, you go to a flat plan because we don't want to experience that again. Or you bump up your minutes. Now, you may never hit those minutes again, but we keep it there. Why? Just in case. Because we overreact to the potential of a loss. Just the thought of a potential loss can lead us to irrational choices. Rental car companies figure that out. You know, rental car companies, they offer this additional insurance when you rent a car. Okay? And most of the time, 99% of the time, you don't need it. You don't need it. Your credit card has insurance on it. Your other things have insurance on it. You don't need it. But the insurance companies offer it. And if you don't want it, they make you sign a loss damage waiver. Because they know just that word, loss. Are you sure? Well, you signed the loss damage waiver then. Oh, well, maybe I should. I don't know. Here's another thing that should make perfect sense, another factor. The more meaningful a potential loss is, the more loss averse we become. Now, if you're like me, if you're thinking, wait a minute. If the more meaningful a loss is, the more loss averse we should become, then shouldn't the airline pilot have been, I mean, isn't the lives of people more meaningful? Yeah. Yes. If that was the loss he was focused on, but as we said, he wasn't. Not at all.
A lot of this deals with our pride.
Pride? There's a lot of factors here. And like I said, I'm just giving you a little bit. You're going to have to flesh this out. Let the Holy Spirit flesh it out in your mind this week. But yeah, pride. There's pride. There's greed. There's, you know, you go back to anger. Some of it, you know, because sometimes we react in anger to our fear. Now, what happens when we have a particular point of view that's being challenged by our spouse or our children or our coworker? How averse do we become about losing the disagreement? Especially if it's meaningful. Well, this is important. This is about the Bible. Just saying. Okay. Here's an opportunity for you to win. Okay? I'm going to give you an opportunity to win, not to lose. Okay. I have a $20 bill. I have a $20 bill. I'm going to auction the $20 bill. All right. We're going to start at $1 and highest bid wins. Now, I got two rules. The increments go up by $1. And this is a real auction, by the way. I'm going to, $20 bill is yours. Highest bidder. Okay. The highest bid wins. The highest bid wins. The only other rule is the second highest bidder, you have to pay your bid too. You're not going to get anything, but second highest bidder has to pay too. So we're going to start at $1. Who's going to bid $1 for this $20 bill? Do I hear one? Do I hear one? $1. Okay. Do I hear two? $2. $2.
$19.
Okay. Do I hear 20? No, you can only bid by $1 at a time. Okay. I got one. $1. Do I hear two? She's going to get this $20 bill for $1, okay? Nobody wants to bid $2.
You have to have the cash on hand.
Yeah, you have to have the cash on hand, okay?
You don't have cash now.
$2. $2. Going once. Bob. I got Bob for $2. Do I hear three? $3. Do I hear four? $4. $4. $4. Four? $4, okay? Five? $6. Six. $7. $7 back here. $8. $9. $9. She's got it for $8. $8 going once. $9 right here. $9. Do I hear 10? $10. $10. $10 right back here. 11. Do I hear 11?
Pastor doesn't walk by.
Do I hear 11? Do I hear 11? I got 10 right back here. Do I hear 11? Do I hear 11 going once? Going twice? Sold for $10 right here. Somebody owes me $9 too.
Yeah, he does.
That's not today.
He had nine. It's right here. Now, you guys did very well at that game. Did I pass you by?
No.
Yes, absolutely. $9 and $10 right here. So,
he almost made the money.
You can pay up after class. So
right here.
You guys did very, very well. Here's what a lot of times happens, and there's almost no chance I'm not going to get really close to making my money back there. Okay, because we feel that first. There's three phases of that auction. The first phase is where it seems really easy, and we want to get something for nothing. Okay, what, a $20 bill for a dollar? A $20 bill for $9? My goodness. Okay. Then there's the last part of the auction where you think, uh-oh.
I just bid last.
Uh-oh, this could get expensive, and I'm kind of in a no-win situation, and I'm going to pay money for something I'm not going to get. And we feel the loss. Okay. The end part is where we're really struggling with that loss. Okay. It's the middle part that you guys successfully navigated. Okay. Those that were bidding. because you stopped. Okay. Because it's that middle part. There's a word that I'm going to use that I don't think we've ever used this word in a negative sense. Okay. But it's the word that kind of comes in under one of these fear factors. That I'm praying you hear this in the right way, because I'm going to use it in a negative way. Most of the time, it's a lack of this that we think is the problem. But when this is combined with aversion to losses, which is where we meet in the middle of this little auction, it tends to be a problem. Commitment. And I say that in a negative way. In the middle of that game is where you realize, uh-oh, I may lose. I better stick to the path I'm on. I better keep bidding so that I'm not the second person that gets nothing for something rather than something for nothing. And we commit to what we've committed to. Now, hear me well. Hear me very well. Because somebody in your head could say, so does that mean that I should stop being afraid of losing my marriage and just quit and give up on my commitment? No. Wrong. The problem is we battle misplaced commitments. You go back to the airline pilot. He had a commitment to being on time. That was a misplaced commitment. He committed to what he committed to. In the middle of this auction, you could commit to, I better not lose. Huh. I think the record for that is $213 for a $20 bill. Done in a, I think it's Harvard economics class. Yeah, you're trying to cut your losses. That's exactly right. You're trying to avoid the loss and you're overreacting to the loss, but at the same time you're committed to your strategy. See, we in this idea of commitment, we lose the big picture. We lose the big picture. We talked about the big picture a few weeks ago. We can maintain our commitment to being happy. Or maintain our commitment to avoiding some sort of pain or some other thing instead of the big picture of what does God want for my life? Well, I feel like I can't be happy. Well, that's the wrong thing to be committed to. You're focused on a lesser commitment. This is exactly how it can be when we fail in communication or we fail in relating. We think, well, this is just the way it's going to be. It's just the way it's going to be. I just have to lose the relationship, you know. Or we keep doing things that may whatever's bad in the first place. We keep doing the same things. You know, why would I change? I'll just get hurt. You know, why they'll never change. She'll never do what I want her to do. He'll never straighten up. I might as well just keep doing what I'm doing. And we may remain committed to what we're committed to. So commitments work when we're committed to the right thing. Commitments fail when we commit to failure. So how to make smarter decisions? How to make smarter decisions? Determine what you're really afraid of losing. Determine what it is that you're really afraid of losing. Is it respect? You afraid of losing face? You afraid of being embarrassed? You afraid of getting out where you're uncomfortable? Are you afraid of losing your free time? Are you afraid of losing other people's good opinion of you? You afraid of losing the argument? And remember, whatever it is, you're probably overreacting to that potential for loss. So determine what you're afraid of losing. And then determine what change in attitude or action you are resisting. Determine what change in attitude or action you are resisting. Are you being lazy? Is go back to the servant. What did the master say to him? You lazy and wicked servant. He just didn't want to get up and do what he was supposed to do. I'll hide it in the ground because I'm afraid. So what attitude do you have that's standing in your way here that is causing you to resist, you know, instead of changing it into a better attitude? Is there a spiritual issue that you need God's help with? An attitude or a habit that needs changing that maybe you've tried to change, but you haven't really let God help you out with that? Or what have you committed yourself to that is taking you right where you don't want to go? What have you committed yourself to that is taking you right where you don't want to go? Okay. Third thing, follow the facts. Follow the facts. Because usually our feelings of potential loss are built on pure speculation. Usually we're dealing with potential. It's our anxiety. But what if I change and do that and I still don't see how that's going to help? Okay. Sometimes there's going to be seemingly conflicting facts. Well, yeah, I see what you're saying, but what about this? And there's going to be conflicting facts. And we'll be tempted to go back to the thing that we're comfortable with and our comfortable stance of keeping things the same. Well, this may work out anyway. Follow the facts. Because sometimes fear will tell us to run. A lot of times fear will tell us to run. Or fear will tell us to hide. Fear will tell us to do something when we should wait. The facts haven't said move, but we're scared that if we don't move, if we don't do something, so we respond. You know, I've heard people say, well, I just need to step out in faith. Well, did God tell you to? Well, yeah, I feel God told me to. Really? Is that God or is that your fear? Because we say, well, you know, I just need to step out in faith because it'll work out. It'll work out. Let me tell you, that's dumb. That's just dumb. That's a continued commitment to trying to do things your way instead of and to do what God hasn't told you to do. The fact is, you only step out in faith when God has, for a fact, told you to do so. That's faith. See, faith follows facts. I have faith in the fact of what God says. He says it in His Word. He says it through His Holy Spirit. That's faith. Faith is not just blindly jumping out there and saying, oh, I'm going to lose if I don't do something. No, no, no. Neither is it hunkering down and hiding when God tells you to move. You go, oh, I don't know. Well, the fact is, if God says go, go. If he doesn't, don't. That's all there is to it. I wish I had time for, I have one really good example, but we got to go. I'm going to let you ponder that this week.